U.S. blocks resolution on Gaza.
Hijab in Turkey.
Russia-U.S. relations.
The international community in Afghanistan.
Israel's escalation of the violence in the Gaza Strip and two-week blockade of the region has given rise to a wave of opposition throughout the world. Representatives of Arab countries at the United Nations and the 57 member states of the Organization of the Islamic Conference have called for a UN Security Council session to be convened on the critical situation in Gaza. Libya, which held the Security Council rotating presidency for the month of January, presented a draft statement to the Security Council, which called on the Zionist regime to halt its crimes and lift the blockade. The draft statement was studied by the 15 Security Council members, and all except the United States supported it. Even amendments to the draft statement, which included a requirement that the Palestinians stop the rocket attacks on the occupied territories launched from Gaza, were not able to end Washington's stubbornness on the resolution. Security Council President Etohi plainly declared that the Council's efforts to adopt a statement in Gaza had failed. The U.S. persistence has once again proven that Security Council cannot issue a non-binding statement condemning the Zionist regime, even over the humanitarian crisis it has caused in Gaza. The United States has demanded that Hamas should be condemned before Israel was censured, and that the prisoner of war Zionist soldier Gilad Shalit should be promptly released. The two issues are not related to the Gaza crisis, and the U.S. only proposed these conditions to ensure that no Security Council resolution was passed. Washington is opposed to the adoption of the UN's resolution against Israel because of the Zionist lobbying influence over the United Nations policymaking bodies and international organizations. Moreover, since 2008 is a presidential election year in the U.S., the Republicans need the support of the Zionist lobby and must pay the price. President Bush's recent visit to Israel, during which he repeated his opposition to granting 5 million Palestinian refugees the right of return to their homeland, shows that he is only trying to convince the Zionist lobby to support the Republicans in the election. Such moves contradict Bush's claims that he would like to see the establishment of a democratic Palestinian state in the occupied territories. Since before proposing the creation of such a state, he would be obliged to convince Israel to accept UN resolutions 194, 232, and 338. But he actually violated resolution 194 during his trip. The U.S. bias toward the Zionist regime is an obstacle to the Palestinian nation's efforts to obtain their undeniable rights. And in such an atmosphere, Israel will not accept the establishment of an independent Palestinian state with Beit al-Muqaddas as its capital. Now, Islamic and Arab countries must stand up for the Palestinians' rights and resist the Western pressure. Otherwise, the situation in Palestine will only take a turn for the worse. We'll be right back.
After months of arguments and counter-arguments, the government in Ankara finally decided to lift the controversial ban on women wearing the Islamic headscarf in universities. This week's decision must be approved by the parliament. Although the ban stays in effect in Turkey's schools and other government institutions, the measure is seen as a big victory for the ruling Justice and Development Party, whose main aim initially was to lift the hijab ban in all sectors. But as the long-awaited government move has raised concerns among hardline secularists, the popular government of Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has decided to proceed with wisdom and extra caution on one of the most sensitive issues in the country of 70 million people. Hijab is indeed an issue of faith and religious freedom. A majority of Turks see the measure as good for both religion and democracy. A Turkish state organization which deals with religious affairs has described the Islamic dress code as a necessity for the people and on par with prayers and fasting. More than 70% of Turkish women are observant Muslims and wear the hijab. Recent opinion polls suggest that most of the people in the country perched between Europe and the Middle East support the decision to lift the ban and do not consider it as against the secular system in their country. A 2006 study by the Turkish Economic and Social Studies Foundation, a respected research institute based in Istanbul, found that 59% of Turks describe themselves as very religious or extremely religious. About two-thirds of the women in the study reported by the Western press, which interviewed 1,500 people, said they covered their heads in some way when they left the house. This is while extremists and secular circles, preoccupied with trying to marry the great Turkish culture to European standards, claim the Islamic attire is a danger to their brand of secularism and should be opposed. For years, the controversy over the hijab in Turkey has attracted public opinion, both in the region and beyond. Human rights organizations and activists have often asked why in a democratic country with a 98% Muslim population, religious and moral values and human rights are ignored. This is while people with other religions are free to practice their faith and wear their religious attire of choice without any restriction. Though the recent successes and efforts by Islamists in Turkey to lift the hijab ban at universities cannot address all the demands of Turkish women, it is a big step in the right direction.
There are growing signs that an already difficult relationship between the United States and Russia is quickly deteriorating into open enmity. Moscow has been increasingly aggressive on foreign policy of late and has challenged Washington on a wide variety of sensitive issues. Just in the last few months, Vladimir Putin's Russia has gone against Washington on Iran, Kosovo, missile defense, NATO expansion, arms treaties, as well as on the other less publicized and behind-the-scenes matters. Analysts expect the bitter rhetoric between the two capitals to get even louder in 2008, since the collision course on some issues could only likely come to their climax this year. Examples include Kosovo and Georgia, where violence is expected if the two sides don't compromise. Experts describe the state of bilateral ties as the worst since the end of the Cold War almost two decades ago. On Iran, the Russians forced the Bush administration to settle for much less than what it had been seeking regarding a third punitive UN Security Council resolution. What's more, over demanding U.S. objections, Moscow has delivered nuclear fuel for the Bushehr atomic reactor. Some reports suggest tensions are running so high that Russian Foreign Minister and his U.S. counterpart Condoleezza Rice are barely on speaking terms. Other areas of friction which risk further worsening of ties include Russia's lack of cooperation with the West on the Litvinenko murder case and Russian long-range bombers flying aggressively close to European and US shores. So why has Russia made such a dramatic shift? Until a few years ago, Moscow was striving for full integration with the West, but now everything seems to have changed. Putin, as well as most of the key decision makers in Russia, have security intelligence KGB backgrounds and are by nature suspicious of the West. Russia is now swimming in petrodollars and can afford to flex its muscles. Most ordinary Russians no longer feel humiliated having to struggle just to survive. Russia now feels it is in a position to rebuild its empire, serve as a counterweight to America, and check the US's excessive power. Furthermore, Russian specialists believe Moscow's interests are now better served both domestically and geopolitically, with the US as an enemy than an ally. Exploding anti-Bush and anti-American sentiments help Putin at home as well as abroad. Last but not least, the Kremlin believes the West exploited Russia's weak post-Cold War position in the early 1990s, and now it is time for payback.
Three reports issued this week highlight the ways in which the outside world is failing the Afghan people and predict that if the international community does not improve its performance, Afghanistan will tumble back into dissent and chaos, and the forces of bigotry will once again seize control. Perhaps the most damning of the findings comes from the aid agency Oxfam, which warns that not only has much of the promised aid not been delivered to Afghanistan, but that which has is often wasted. The loss stems from poor project coordination, the engagement of expensive outside consultants, and the high prices being charged by international contractors. The rebuilding and economic advancement of Afghanistan was not supposed to turn into payola for international firms. It was supposed to give Afghans the first chance in decades to build some stability and prosperity into their lives. That is not happening. And because it is not happening, Afghans struggling to feed their families are turning increasingly to the warlords over their communities, and in agricultural areas are cultivating the opium poppy. As despair and crime take a deeper hold, so will lawlessness, and so will the task facing the Afghan security forces and the NATO troops alongside them. It is the security situation which one of the American reports highlights, warning it is deteriorating because of a lackluster military performance by NATO. Only a few of the NATO contingents are actually engaged in any fighting. Many member countries have only supplied troops on the basis that they will be posted to provinces as yet untouched by violence, or will be used only for training and supply duties. The international community had promised effective financial and technical aid in great quantities. Those hopes are now being dashed, and Afghans being increasingly tempted to find their own solutions by themselves. Both militarily and economically, Afghanistan is being betrayed, thanks to broken donor promises, cowardly governments, and the incompetent mishmash being made of implementing much of the aid that has been delivered. It is shameful.